Inmates involved in the 1971 Attica uprising are still facing repercussions as a result of their actions. 62 of them have been named in 42 indictments stemming from the rebellion. No law enforcement personnel or prison officials have been named. In fact, two attorneys have resigned from the prosecution team, charging that the prosecution has been negligent in pursuing possible crimes committed by law officers. The indicted inmates have been charged with over 1,400 felony counts, including murder, kidnapping, assault, possession of contraband, and possession of weapons. If convicted, they will face collectively 60,000 years in prison. Two inmates, John Hill and Charles Panassilis, were convicted last week of the murder of a guard. One of those awaiting trial is Dalu Asahi. In July 1969, Asahi, then a member of the Young Lords organization, was convicted of robbery and sentenced to 4 to 12 years in jail. He spent 5 years in prison, the last two in Attica. During the uprising, Asahi was elected by the participating inmates to be a spokesperson for them, and he was also involved in the negotiating team. After the rebellion, Asahi was identified as a ringleader by prison officials, and because of this, he says, he spent the rest of his time there in a special housing unit reserved for 80 troublemakers. Asahi is among 8 men vocal during the uprising who have been charged with murder. He is accused of killing an inmate, but he claims he was selected for prosecution because of his outspokenness, and says that although he has been ready to go to trial since the summer, the state has repeatedly delayed it. Asahi, who is now a student at Buffalo University in New York and a member of Attica Now, a political and legal defense organization, was in Los Angeles last week, where I had the opportunity to talk with him.
What are the reasons that that uprising occurred?
There were many. Basically, behind the constant police repression coming and stemming down specifically against a lot of political activists, members of Young Lords, of which I was a member of that. Young Lords is a Puerto Rican revolutionary organization, and Panthers, and whether people, and we used to have coalitions, and the administration used to harass us by giving us disciplinary infractions for all types of, alleged violations of administrative rules. They would come in our cells and ransack it, and then confiscate our writings and give us disciplinary infractions for possession of inflammatory literature. Another situation would come, for example, was the general conditions. If we would get mail, they would censor the mail and would literally, scratch out, incoming mail, which they felt was bad for our character. Or if we get a periodical, magazine, newspaper, they would literally cut it out. And if you get a paper, you have a cutout instead of a newspaper. Among the other reasons were the medical conditions, the censorship, and, the type of administrative harassment which came down. For example, we had various grievances submitted to the administration, and the signers of those petitions were faced with administrative transfers and with punitive segregation, as reprisals for taking signatures or for writing up the grievances.
How many inmates were there at that time in Attica?
There were approximately 2,200 inmates at Attica, and about 1,200 participated in the uprising, and the rest that didn't, or the majority didn't participate, basically because they were physically unable to. That is, the administration and the guards had access to that, whereas we didn't. And the other half, I guess by their own choosing, did not want to participate.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just a spontaneous thing. It was something that had been brewing for a long time.
It was brewing by the condition and the atmosphere, right? However, it was spontaneous in as much that what had happened was, like, for example, on September 8th of 1971, two prisoners were sparring in one part of the prison. The prison is broken up into four parts, A, B, C, and D. And in A block, that's where two prisoners were sparring. And the goon squad, which consists of 12 to 18 guards who come padded with riot batons and helmets, came to physically remove these two people from the yard, and the rest of the people in the housing block that was out in recreation, went around the guards and told them that, you know, they weren't fighting and not to remove them. So I guess the guards had backed off. I wasn't knocking that area. This is accounts that I have gotten from prisoners. And the situation was that after everyone knocked up, at 4 o'clock, everyone stays and, you know, returns to their respective cells. And the goon squad came and, you know, beat and physically took these two prisoners to the special housing unit, which is a euphemism for segregation. And during that course, a lot of prisoners are locked in that company or gallery or tier, right? Had thrown obscenities at guards, and the guards had put disciplinary infractions against some of the members of that cell, which a cell, you know, cell company consists of about 42 cells, and about 11 people were locked up. Next morning, since that's the last company to eat, you know, breakfast, they had let those that weren't faced with disciplinary action go to breakfast. And on the way out, the control box, which opens the cells, our manual cells, as prisoners passed, they cracked open the cell doors to the prisoners that had disciplinary infractions. And the guard let them go to breakfast and then panic and call the lieutenant. The lieutenant says, well, instead of them going out to the recreation yard, lock up the yard and take them back to their cells, and I'll meet you halfway. And as the prisoners had come back, the guard and the lieutenant got into an argument with some of the prisoners there, and a fight broke out, and the keys were confiscated. It sparked, you know, the uprising just like that, because there were other prisoners in the yard. When the doors opened, they participated, and then they ran into the area of Times Square, which is the center which controls, you know, access to all the cell blocks. And one of the bolts gave way inside, you know, the bars, the gates, and there were two guards in there that had the keys, you know, to that control area. And when the bolts gave down, the keys were confiscated, and, you know, all the inmates spread out to the other areas. And then I was locked in the middle, you know, B block, where the metal shop is. And the situation was that I heard the whistle and the siren go off, and I knew that the only time that would have, you know, that would sound off in any prison is when someone escapes or there's a problem inside the institution. Mm-hmm. And I guess the people, you know, who have felt the tension and everything took advantage of that situation and just participated in, you know, physically releasing their frustration against the machines and, you know, the shop areas where they work and the cells, etc. And that's how it went. It was pretty chaotic for the first 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And after that, guards were taken hostages, and most of the prisoners just mingled around into the D yard area, which was where we had stayed for the last, you know, next 4 days that followed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the events that took place after that are fairly familiar to most people. I imagine the taking of the hostages, the holding of the hostages, and then finally the entrance by the National Guard and the state troopers.
11 deputy sheriff's departments. Mm-hmm. You know.
And then, of course, the murder of the hostages and the inmates. How many inmates were killed?
As a whole, the situation was that 39 people had died of gunshot wounds, right? And the only one who had weapons, you know, guns at that time was law enforcement personnel. The state has claimed that one guard, William Quinn, who died prior to the retaking of the prison, right, and three prisoners that had been killed prior to the retaking of the prisoners. So the total was 43 people who had died, 11 guards, and the rest were inmates.
Did conditions change at all after the uprising?
Contrary to the commissioner's promises of granting us 28 demands, the only significant changes, if you want to call them that, has been that instead of having toilet paper rationed once a month, now you could get it upon request. And instead of taking showers once a week, now they give you two showers. And they removed the visiting screen from, you know, the visiting room between inmates and their relatives or friends of visitors, and at the same time had doubled the width of the table. That's the only changes that have been. Most of the changes have been towards the administration. In terms of what they've done, they have reduced the population from 2,200 to 1,200. They have instituted one-third, you know, in percentage of prison personnel has been increased by that much, and they've placed four new sentry gun posts inside the yard, and more training and riot control for the, you know, prison personnel, and the atmosphere still remains tense.
Do you foresee a similar kind of uprising taking place?
Definitely I do. I do it, you know, I see it because of not a single person who's in a position to, you know, who allegedly represent the interests of the people, or who is in a government administration, not necessarily state but federal, there has not been any challenge made, you know, towards the type of force that has been made. If you know, situation was that when the troopers and the state personnel came into the prison, they used the riot guns, which are the 12 gauge shotguns, and they used the 00 buckshot ammunition, and the sniper rifles, which were 270 Winchesters, which are used for hunting, they loaded, and the type of, you know, the weapons and the type of ammunition that they used was banned by the Geneva Conference, you know, for causing unnecessary suffering. And these are commonly known as dum-dum bullets, which expand as they hit, you know, an object or a person.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're going around the West Coast now talking to people. What are you telling them?
Well, basically, we have the film, the Attica film, which exposes most of the conditions by prisoners' testimony in there, and as well by prison administrators. And also, it has excerpts of the, you know, uprising during the prison, you know, the prison takeover, as well as excerpts of state police shooting into the yard. And, you know, the process is twofold. It's one, to raise the level of consciousness, you know, of many people to the facts that are going on around the case, and, you know, the comparison between Attica of 1971 and 75. And the only difference is that in 1971 they used bullets, you know, to quell down the rebellion. And the different, you know, the other, on the other hand, they're using the legal systems to legalize, you know, lynchings for, you know, against the prisoners to cover up, you know, the atrocities and beatings which follow right after the massacre by the state.
What were most of the people in Attica there for?
It's hard to say because it range, you know, I had statistics say that there were a high percentage of, you know, murder cases and burglaries and drug-related cases, right? But they had mingled a lot. For example, Attica at that time was supposed to only hold persons over 21 years of age. When I went to Attica, I was 19. Mm. You know, and the two Native Americans, you know, that are on trial now for the alleged murder of the guard, William Quinn, they were also respectively 18 and, you know, 19. And the situation is that it had varied. I was there as a first offender, and I was confined around, you know, people that were consistent felony offenders. Charlie Joe Panassilis was in there for, you know, riding, you know, driving a car without a license, and, you know, they placed him in Attica too. So it varies. There was, you know, all types of people that were in there. Basically, crimes ranging from robbery, burglary, and crimes that you see that, like, Nixon's crew, the Watergate crew, and Agnew and them, you won't find people like that in there. You know, you find them in maybe a federal camps where they have tennis courts and horseback riding, you know, that type of imprisonment for them. But at Attica, you'll find most people that had come from urban area, over 85% of the prison population in New York, in Attica was, you know, third world. And in New York State as a whole, over 68% were predominantly black and other minorities.
In the New York State prison system?
In New York State's prison system.
Right. Well, how do you think the state should deal with these people who are accused of crimes or convicted of crimes?
Well, you know, it's a thing when we have to look at, you know, the first process of when or why people go to crime, you know, to prison, and why do people commit crimes, and that reflects a lot upon, you know, society. For example, you know, like with the rate of inflation now, mm-hmm. and you know, the layoffs that are, you know, coming down, there's gonna be people that are gonna start struggling for survival, man. That means a lot of people is gonna start expropriating for food for survival, and, you know, doing that, or this law says that a person will be charged with robbery, you know, or burglary, you know, for stealing food. And, you know, the judicial system does not function, man, as due process or equal protection under the law for both, you know, for all people. You know, you could see at the situation with Agnew, who's the only man that I know that within 48 hours was indicted, pled guilty, was sentenced, and walked out of prison, with, you know, walked out of the courtroom, for, you know, and a fine with $10,000, which he had, you know, in the whole penal system. You know, and you don't find that happening predominantly to people that come from lower economical backgrounds. And, you know, the type of guards that, you know, run these institutions, man, or, you know, it has to be focused upon that most of the prisons that we've, you know, in our society are located in rural areas. Like at Attica, they didn't have one single black guard that worked there. And the situation that Attica is located like 4 miles, 40 miles east of Buffalo, and is located in a rural area where, you know, like the mayor of the town is a guard at Attica too. And the situation is that, you know, these are people, you know, most guards that come there are people that, you know, are tired of army life, you know, can't make it in the advertisement business of selling cars, you know, and these are people that have farms, work with cows and pigs, and, you know, they come in there and they're gonna administer corrections on people that they don't even understand the social, economic, cultural, and much less environmental lifestyle, mm-hmm. you know, and clearly there's gonna be tension, you know, and a lack of communication and understanding.
So leaving aside the social conditions that you say force people to go out and commit crimes and this kind of thing, you think that the administration of the penal institution should be composed of peers of inmates? Yeah?
True. Another thing is that in a situation, you know, where people, society as a whole, there has been no type of changes in prison because the society have alienated themselves from, you know, convicted or felony offenders. The situation is that, you know, the type of hostilities, harassments, and the hardships that prisoners face once released is a type of situation where they can't vote, you know, that's one. The type of vocational training, for example, at Auburn Prison, which is the only state in New York or state that produces license plate. Here is a person go there and they'll force them to work in the license plate shop and get certificates, 4 or 5 certificates in a period of 5 or 10 years, and the prisoner gets released, and it'll be real dissolution when he finds out that nowhere else in New York State they make license plate but at Auburn State Prison. So, you know, the vocational training is inadequate. For example, the pay at Attica was, the standard pay was 25 cents a day for working 5 hours, mm-hmm. you know, and it's things that people have to understand that the institutions, the prison institutions, are profitable for, you know, the state, because what would happen is that Attica makes an average of $1.2 million in profits in the metal shop, and they produce metal cabinets and gym lockers that you will find in your schools and public, you know, institutions, and the prisoners, you know, it's mandatory for prisoners to work, you know, and the law says that, you know, so then you got to be able to conceptualize it. And they claim that, well, they need more programs, they need more money. And, you know, the area is what they need more money for. You know, they claim it's already soaking out taxpayers' money to keep the prisoners. They feed at Attica, for example, prior to the uprising, the per capita feed for prisoners were 62 cents a day. You know, and the reform that they made is now that they made an increase of 5 cents. Now they feed you on 67 cents a day. And this is below the you know, nutritious value set by the welfare department. Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, you have these conditions, and you have the institution itself where you have a sort of nepotism, you know, that's I think what it's called, where, you know, the guards that work there, like, as handed down, where your brother will work there, your father will work there, and your cousin will work there, and everyone that lives right in the village of Attica works in the institution, and the money goes back to the State Department of Corrections and to the village, you know, and the county in which the prison sits. Now, one of the things is that, you know, people abhor, you know, the type of situation where, you know, a person is a convict, man. And the thing is that, you know, a person doesn't necessarily have to be guilty of a crime. It only takes the attitude of a policeman, a law enforcement official out here to pat someone down, even if you're clean, no witnesses around, and come out your pocket with a stick of marijuana, you know, or anything else they put on you. And then you go to court. If you don't have no witnesses, it's going to be your word against the testimony of the police. And 9 out of 10 times, you're going to get convicted, you know, because especially if you aren't unemployed, you have no, you know, credentials to put you up as an upstanding citizen and productive citizen in society, or is it going to be your words against, you know, a public official who defends public order? And, you know, people don't understand that it could happen to anybody. It won't happen to Rockefellers and Mellons and DuPonts. You know, they control the economy, but to the average citizens it could.
All right, you brought up Rockefeller, and of course he played a very integral role during the Attica uprising, during this trial that's just finished for Hill and Pernesales. They tried to subpoena him, of course that was turned down. What about Rockefeller's role in this?
Well, we hold him responsible as former chief executive of the state of New York, that is, for being governor. Contrary to what he has said, all the, you know, the mass media, establishment media has gone around him, and every time he's ready to announce a public statement, you know, it gets assimilated among, you know, the population real quickly. And he's been very damaged, you know, in terms of these cases. For example, he condoned and confirmed the actions that, you know, the prisoners at Attica had slashed the throats of hostages, and that's what motivated the state personnel into coming into Attica. And he maintained that, and he didn't even give an apology for making, you know, giving out misinformation. What he has done is, when he testified before the Senate Rules Committee and the House Judiciary Committee for his confirmation hearing, he repeatedly stated that the guard William Quinn was thrown out of a window. And, you know, that's a contradiction, because not only at Attica, but all state maximum security prisons, you know, all the windows are barred, you know. So, you know, nothing has been done to charge him with perjury. He testified both times under oath, you know, and the defense wanted him to testify in the case as to where he got his sources, and the court wouldn't allow it, you know. And, you know, obviously, because he's a powerful man, nothing has been done, and the court, you know, has just overruled the defense motion, and he wasn't bought, and the subpoena was turned down. Mm-hmm. Now, a situation with him is that, you know, he claimed that he gave the order, and he's responsible for what happened, and he felt that no further negotiations had come. However, there was during the whole negotiations, the key demand was amnesty, you know, and it's a situation where we, the prisoners, wanted Rockefeller to meet with the observers, not to come in the yard, like he says, not to come in the yards and negotiate with us. It would be foolish for us to expect them to come in, to walk into a prison, especially with all the animosity and antagonisms that a lot of prisoners had. But the observers' request was for him to meet with them, and we wanted him to publicly say, no, you will not get amnesty. You know, if he would have given us that opportunity, perhaps the changing of demand, like we had two other demands, a transportation to a non-imperialist country, and after we negotiated for a couple of hours and the observers came back that this is not a realistic demand, that we will not get no place with this because it will set precedents and other prisons will, you know, have uprisings behind us, then we put it to the majority of the population of the rebelling Attica inmates, and by majority vote we said, well, let's take that demand out. If Rockefeller would have afforded us that opportunity to say amnesty is non-negotiable, we could have softened on the amnesty demand if the prisoners was faced with the objective of either releasing the hostages or the law enforcement personnel storming the troop, you know, storming the prison. And they didn't do that. To the contrary, they came in there and they didn't even tell us gay submitted to us an ultimatum of releasing the hostages, or, you know, they'll come in shooting.
Mm-hmm. What do you think you've learned from the uprising and the events that followed?
What I've learned, and I seriously consider, is that hostages are just as expendable as prisoners. You know, and the situation is that if people fail to get involved in making changes inside the prisons, the situation would occur where the repression will increase inside the prisons, and when the prisoners have grievances, they're going to take it out individually against the guards. And next time there'll be uprisings, there won't be no hostages. You know, because they will see that the only way of releasing their hostages, they will be forced to the situation where the prisoner has to start struggling for survival. You know, and if it means self-defense, and, you know, so that they could defend their own lives, and in the process, you know, they're going to go, they're going to realize that, you know, death to them is imminent, and a lot of people is going to make the decision of not to die by themselves. Mm. You know, and that's what I've learned from Attica.